Welcome to the Startups Middle East podcast. I'm your host, Evrim, and I interview startup founders and people relevant to startups all around the Middle East. In this episode, I'm interviewing Trey Gady. Trey is the head of portfolio management for Aramco Entrepreneurship Ventures, a $200 million venture fund launched by Saudi Aramco. Being a longtime entrepreneur himself that started numerous startups and raised millions of dollars in funding, he had a lot of interesting stories to tell. Here's the interview. Trey, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you, sir. Nice to be here.
So, tell us a little bit about your background. Many people know you from Saudi Aramco, your role at Saudi Aramco, but you also have a company called Affinity Wind. You're an entrepreneur yourself. So tell us a little bit about your background and why you're interested in entrepreneurship.
Sure. Thank you, sir. So I arrived in Saudi Arabia 5 years ago, almost exactly 5 years ago. But prior to that, I had been an entrepreneur and several other things in my hometown of St. Louis, Missouri, which is right in the middle of the United States, a little bit south of Chicago. And I got my first taste of entrepreneurship when I was fortunate enough to find a mentor at a very young age, call it 25 years old. And he had a cash cow business where they were running fantasy sports, like fantasy football, fantasy soccer, fantasy basketball.
That's a big thing in the U.S., right?
Yeah, it's a huge market. And my mentor, my oldest mentor and still to this day probably one of my best, was the pioneer in that space. And it was right around the time that AOL was becoming popular. And he had the idea, along with myself, to put the fantasy sports game on the internet and move it away from a call center. So we were well capitalized by that cash cow fantasy sports business, but we launched an internet service provider when, in my hometown, the only other provider was AOL. And that is generally where I cut my teeth, lost all my hair, and I would not change any of the experiences over the 5 years as we became the seventh fastest growing technology company in the United States. Wow. We went from two or three employees to close to 500 in 4.5 years. We raised $53 million of venture capital. Bearing in mind, these were the dot-com days. You can Google dot-com days for you young listeners out there. And it was an exciting ride. We had to learn a lot. We hadn't really done it before. We had a tiger by the tail, and it grew and grew and grew. We did 16 acquisitions throughout the Midwest, part of the United States, and successfully sold that company in March of 2000, literally right as the dot-com bust was happening. And we sold to a publicly traded company called Empower Communications, and life was good. But
what was the name of the company, by the way, that you were a part of?
Yeah, good question. It was called Primary Network. It's still in business today. Primary.net.
All right.
Was our URL. The stock that we received in this publicly traded company went from $60 to $1.50 in less than 2 to 3 months. But that was fine. The experience was worth it. I was still young, and I took some time off given some non-compete language. I did not go to Empower Communications. They wanted me to move to Rochester, New York, and I had family and other ties in St. Louis that I needed to attend to. But after a year kind of doing some consulting work, I hooked back up with my same mentor, whose name is Brian Matthews. And we launched a number of other companies, and we actually ended up buying back Primary Network and all of its subsidiaries because Empower, when their stock went from $60 to $1.50, they filed for, I think it was Chapter 7 bankruptcy. So we took the company back. It's still in business today. I think that's a testament to how we, you know, always had the bootstrapped mentality. We never went out and bought the nicest, fanciest office space. It was just nuts and bolts, run the business, lean and mean. While we bought that company back from Empower Communications about a year or two later, we started a number of other businesses, probably over 20 businesses. Many of them failed. Some of them broke even. I love talking about the failures. We started an online backup. It was called eBackups. And we thought we could roll it out to our base of customers. It didn't work. We were charging, I think, $10 a month, and we were too soon. You know, today it's a little bit different, obviously, with the technology that's out there. I could talk for an hour about all the failures, but some of the other cool ones that did work out, we formed a broadband over power line company called Electric Internet, powered by Ameren. And Ameren is the investor-owned utility, public utility, that serves a couple of states in the Midwest. And we were doing internet over PLC or power line communications, where it came out of a socket, an electric socket, instead of fiber optic cable or Ethernet. We also had a software division where we created our own intranet to help us run primary net more efficiently, and it was web-based, and we productized that and sold it to our competition, basically. And we were fortunate enough to get AOL's Netscape division as a customer, and that kind of took us nationwide. And then the second biggest company that became a customer was called Clearwire, and they were a WiMAX company founded by Craig McCaw, a telecom billionaire. And he took that company and its service global. And that was kind of my first exposure to the global market. And then they ended up buying the company and several others. Again, 20 plus companies, and it was a lot of fun. I'd be remiss if I didn't say, because I thoroughly enjoyed it, I got asked to be a guest speaker at St. Louis University in the entrepreneur department there probably in 2003. And then they asked me to become an adjunct professor. And I, still to this day, I was the longest running adjunct professor in the business school at St. Louis University for 8 years. I left that job when I came to Saudi Arabia in 2012. But it was great. We had a lot of flexibility with the program. And the year that I left, we had become the, I think, 13th best entrepreneur, 7th or 13th best entrepreneur department in the United States. And I still maintain contact with my colleagues from St. Louis University. Two more things, and then we'll get to kind of current day.
I can listen to that for an hour. The very impressive background. There must be a million stories among all those things that you just, you know, quickly told us about.
Yes. So I, in probably 2007, while teaching at St. Louis University, there was a program at St. Louis University, which I would encourage other universities here to adopt, but for a donation to the department, anyone could bring a business idea to our entrepreneur department and have an undergrad or MBA student do a business plan for that business concept or business idea. So while teaching, I made a donation to my own department so that I can maintain the rights to the idea. And we worked on a utility scale commercial wind energy development company and actually located a project site that we believed could hold up to 150 megawatt wind project. And at the end of the semester, after working with an MBA team at St. Louis University, I thought it was feasible enough. My mentor said, "Trey, you know, this looks like a great opportunity. You know, we'll cover your day-to-day role at the group of technology and ICT companies called River City Internet Group." And I amicably left. My mentor invested in Affinity Wind. So we capitalized the company in a very difficult manner, because it was late 2007, when there was a huge market downtime and there was all kinds of government bailout going on. Again, this is a while ago for the young listeners here. But we were fortunate to have raised about $1.6 million to give us development capital to continue to put money into a project in South Central Illinois. And then we were fortunate enough to secure a joint venture with, at the time, the second largest wind energy wind turbine manufacturer called Suzlon out of Pune, India, and they committed another $3.5 million of development capital because it's not cheap to build, you know, a $250 million wind project. They were a great partner, and I'm not making excuses, but the wind energy development business is absolutely for bigger players than Affinity Wind. And another difficult situation was the fact that, let's say it was a $100 million project. The government, the U.S. government, was making available to promote clean energy, renewable energy, something called a production tax credit. And it was essentially a tax credit worth 30% of the project cost. So if you built a $100 million project, you would get a kickback or a subsidy from the United States for $30 million. And that helps the project economics make sense. Unfortunately, as right in 2008, that subsidy was being left to expire on an annual basis, and it's tough to build a wind project in 12 months, and there was a lot of uncertainty whether or not it was going to be reinstated every year. Long story short, we didn't make it. We did, fortunately, we were able to sell two of the projects to a larger developer that is still looking to get turbines operational on the land, and that would be a great thing for Affinity Wind and its shareholders.
That sounds really, really amazing, interesting. It's just so what you meant was the subsidy. When they give you the tax credit, you need to use it within a year or it expires. Is that correct? Did I get it correct?
Close, yes. Okay. You're building a $100 million project, and if you can get it built in a calendar year when that subsidy was available, you would get, over time, 30% of the project cost back.
I see. So the subsidy is completely lifted now. There's no subsidy anymore.
Yeah, you know what? I think it... I have not been following it it's been left to expire and then renewed, left to expire and renewed. I believe that it was in late last year renewed again on an annual basis. And the thing is, there's just no certainty. Like, you had to have 10% of the $100 million project spent, you know, turbine foundations built. And, you know, if you didn't cross that barrier, you know, then you were in jeopardy of not getting the 30% tax credit, which is a lot of money.
Yeah.
It was just difficult because these projects take, you know, years to get turbine spinning, long story short.
Mm. So you have a lot of experience raising funds. Let's start with Primary Network. What was your role there when you guys were raising funds?
Yeah, basically it was myself, my mentor, and one other gentleman. We didn't like the founder or co-founder terms there, but I was an executive vice president when we had staff to actually justify that title. But it was three of us working very hard to productize, market, sell, you know, build operations to be able to support Primary Network, again, from a very small company to a very large, you know, regional telecommunications company.
So what was it like raising the funds? How long did it take you? And, you know, any horror stories, any lessons learned?
Yeah. So, man, I've done it a couple of times, but keep in mind, this was, you know, pre.com bust.
Yeah. Yeah.
I do not by any stretch want to say it was easy, but I think it might've been a little bit easier than it was after the dot-com crash because we were in a hot space. We also got in, we were a telecommunications company as well, where we could provide local and long distance telephone service to landlines. We sold cellular phones through what's now AT&T, but it was called Southwestern Bell at the time. And the reason we became a phone company is to be able to do digital subscriber line, which was high-speed internet. So we could provide the DSL line, the internet access, local telephone, long distance, and that was a very hot market. And it was kind of regionalized, and we were, you know, one of the better ones in the Midwest. So it took some time. We talked to a lot of people. We did hire an investment advisor that helped get us in front of the right people, and fortunately for us, it worked out.
So I want to ask you a question that I read today in Founders at Work. They were asking, I don't know what company they were asking that question to, but was there any point that, I mean, it's impossible that there wasn't, but what was a point that you can remember that you got screwed over or something? Any interesting story?
Screwed over by who or what?
By anything, any deal during your, you know, any fundraising maybe? I think they were talking to the creators of VisiCalc.
Okay.
And that was the question she was asking the guy. And I thought, I want to ask this question to you know, the next person I'm going to be interviewing.
screwed over is a strong word, but things change when you raise money. And it makes sense. It makes more sense to me, having done this on both sides, where I've invested even before I was with Aramco and I've raised money. At the end of the day, the investor is giving you money, and they want to see that $1 million or $53 million, you know, turn into 10 times that money in a period of, call it 3 to 7 years. And as soon as you don't do what you say you're going to do, or you miss your plan, or something bad goes wrong, investors have the right, in my opinion, to be angry. So again, that's not screwed over. But it's, you definitely have more people to answer to, and that's a challenge for entrepreneurs when they raise money. You know, investors now have a say in how the business is strategically run and operated. And then the other, you know, difficult thing for companies that I've seen over the course of my career is going from a private company with or without outside investors going public, you know, through an IPO, an initial public offering, because then you have you are a publicly traded company, and there's a whole lot of different things that go into reporting and accountability from a public company standpoint in Saudi on the Tadawul or on the, you know, NASDAQ or New York Stock Exchange in the United States.
Hey there, it's Ivram again. I hope you're enjoying the interview. Before we continue, though, I have a quick announcement to make. I'm the founder of a startup called Automated Hotel, and we're working on redefining the guest experience in the hospitality industry. The guest experience is still very traditional in hotel rooms: print menus and marketing materials, phone calls for requests. We are developing in-room tablets that allow hotel guests to manage their stay and request services from the hotel, while helping the hotel collect insightful guest data and save staff time. No matter where you're listening to this from, if you're a software developer with experience in React Native or Ruby on Rails, or if you're an investor interested in investing in an opportunity like this, or if you're just interested in the idea and would like to connect with me, I'd love to hear from you. You can get in touch with me at evrim@automatedhotel.com. It's evrim@automatedhotel.com. Or by sending a message through the contact form on startupsmiddleeast.com. All right, back to the interview. So let's talk about your role at Saudi Aramco. What do you do there? And you said you started in 2012, I think, right?
Yeah, I got on a plane New Year's Eve 2012, so technically that's accurate. But I started early 2013, and that's 5 years as we're talking right now. One more thing I want to back up, because I think it's another cool story, just showing again, you know, how important mentors are. Before I made the decision to come to Saudi Arabia and work for Saudi Aramco, I was working again with my mentor, Brian Matthews, and we were trying to solve for my second or third tier city of St. Louis in the United States the missing component in our own entrepreneurial ecosystem, and that was true venture capital, true Series A type stuff, whether you call it $3 million to $10 million investments. That piece of our puzzle in St. Louis was not there, so we said, heck, let's go out and do this ourselves. So we formed Cultivation Capital, and I was a part of that. And I don't look back. I have no regrets, because the 5 years here have been, you know, some of the greatest 5 years of my life being in the region and with Aramco. But Cultivation Capital successfully raised. I was there for the investment committee for the first three deals. We invested in two deals, and then I got on a plane to Saudi. But today, Cultivation Capital, they have seven standalone funds, three technology funds, a biotech fund, an ag tech fund, a couple of accelerators. So it's great to see my mentor continue to have the energy at, you know, he's been doing this longer than myself. He is still extremely active in this space and a great, you know, advocate for entrepreneurship in my hometown of St. Louis. But I could not pass up the opportunity to come to Saudi Aramco. Before I came, I reached out to my network and those individuals that had experience in the region. I heard some great things. You know, it was still some risk because I had not been past Europe. I had never been to the region. But I dove right in along with my wife. And again, professionally and personally, it's exceeded all our expectations. So what I'm doing for Aramco, it's within the Saudi Aramco Entrepreneurship Center, otherwise known as WAD, or also known as WAD. And they were launching a $200 million venture capital fund to invest in companies across multiple sectors where we can diversify the economy, create Saudi jobs, innovation, knowledge transfer, cool tech. And we've had a lot of success over the last 5 years and showing no signs of slowing down.
How many companies have you guys invested in so far?
Yeah, I believe the closed transactions is approaching 15.
Okay. And how about some success stories among the ones like that you funded?
Yeah. So we've got, again, it's a diverse portfolio, but I'll talk about a couple of them. There's one company called Safe Road, and Safe Road is a vehicle monitoring service, AVL, GPS monitored software and hardware provider, where they can manage fleet services for very large companies and do it with more services at a cheaper cost. So it's a huge win-win for our Safe Road customers. When they came in and knocked on our door, or they were referred to me probably 3.5-4 years ago, they had 3,000 to 4,000 devices. And fast forward to today, we invested and closed the deal maybe 2 years ago. They're over 25,000 devices, and they can offer their service globally. So that's been a fun one to watch grow. Another one that has a lot of exposure in the region is PayTabs. And Abdelaziz Al-Jouf has done a fantastic job managing that company through ups and downs, and he's been on and up for the last several years, I'd say. But they're offering payment services that are kind of tailored and catered to the region, but we have found gaps in the market in other regions, so we are expanding into Asia, large companies like India. And again, that's been a lot of fun to watch grow. There's another company called Virtual Vision. Virtual Vision is an ICT cloud services provider. They were and have been the Microsoft Partner of the Year for two out of the last 5 years. And we have plans to do more in the cloud space as it relates to data center offerings and how do we expand the public use of cloud rather than just private cloud. So that's another great one. We did a cool company in collaboration or in co-investment with Kaust. That company's called FalconViz, and it's got some drone technology that is applicable for pipeline monitoring, disaster type situations, and we've seen some good traction from that company as well.
You said you invested in diverse set of companies, but what are some criteria do you use to pick companies, and what stage of companies do you, are you guys generally interested in?
Yeah, so we have gone early, and we have gone through, you know, kind of early stage pre-revenue at times, all the way through venture capital and growth capital for SMEs. The biggest factor, it has to be attractive from a financial standpoint, but as important is the social component of job creation and diversification in Saudi Arabia.
All right. So what do you think about the startup ecosystem in Saudi Arabia?
Yeah, so
both the good and the bad.
Yes. Mm-hmm. It is definitely evolving, and I am very happy at the progress that's been made for my short 5 years here. There's still a lot of room to grow and make it stronger, but there has been visible improvements. One of my favorite stories to tell is I was asked to teach a business planning class at KFUPM, King Fahd University of Petroleum and Minerals here in Saudi, in March of 2013. And there were 50 to 70 students in the class. And I asked them before I got into the material, how many of you want to start your own business? And I think it was about 30% raised their hand. Fast forward just a short 12 months later, I taught that same class and I asked that same question, how many of you want to start your own business? And it was a different group of kids, but it was closer to 70-75% of the people in the class wanted to start their own business. So I think where it was extremely risk averse, you know, in the mindset of people and would they take the risk of starting their own business, there has been improvement and people are taking more risk. So that's great, you know, at the entrepreneur level. It's clear, you know, with Saudi Aramco, you know, leading the way, that the corporates are taking notice of SMEs and what startups can do for the economy. Same can be said for all of the great accelerators and incubators, whether publicly or privately sponsored. You know, the incubators and accelerators were popping up kind of right as I got here, and you know, they're startups in itself as well. So it's been cool to watch the demo days for these different, you know, incubators and accelerators, or the quality of companies, the quality of entrepreneurs, the quality of product getting better, you know, each 6-12 months, because, you know, they're figuring out as an accelerator or an incubator how to do things better. They're learning. There's a learning curve. The government has done a great job. Again, there's been documented progress where they're making changes to companies' laws to better support entrepreneurs, startups, small to mid-size enterprises here in Saudi. They launched the SME Authority, now known as Manshaat, and they put on a great program in Riyadh probably 6 months ago called Biban, and there was more excitement than I've seen, you know, than any other conference in the region. And it was great to see, you know, all of the entrepreneurs and kind of stakeholders in one place for the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia. The universities are another component. I think every one of the universities in Saudi is thinking in some capacity of what can we do regarding entrepreneurship and coursework offerings. Some universities have done more. I've worked, as mentioned, with KFUTM, Prince Mohammed University, as well as KAUST. But WAAD specifically has run programs for all of the universities in the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia. So everyone is kind of doing their part, and it's about collaboration now and how do those stakeholders come together to make it even stronger.
So if you, let's say you have the power to change one thing in the ecosystem there, what do you think it would change?
I don't think there's a silver bullet.
What's the thing that you think to yourself most about, like, I wish this was a bit better, or I wish, you know, this was improving faster?
Again, it's I mean, I'm not saying there's 20 things that I'd like to change, but I don't know which one's important. I think it's all those stakeholders that I just mentioned continuing to do their part. I mean, the quality of deals that we're seeing are definitely better than 5 years ago because, again, the ecosystem is evolving. I think there's better mentors. You know, as a venture capital fund, maybe there's 15 to 20 active VCs in the GCC. We need more. So that's one thing. You know, I feel bad for entrepreneurs because all of the venture capital companies here in the region have their own investment criteria, and it's not always a fit for everyone's. And you know, maybe it means more angel investors or true early stage, seed stage type investors. You know, there's always a need for change. Yeah, the company's laws, regulation. Yeah, it's unfortunate, but there's companies in the region and in Saudi Arabia that are going to more favorable jurisdictions to incorporate their company for the ability to offer stock options to their employees or for investors being able to have preferred shares. You know, those two things are not offered here in the region completely yet. Additionally, there's at times better bankruptcy protection in foreign jurisdictions. So yeah, there's still a lot of work to do. We all need to keep our eye on the ball. But I don't have a silver bullet that says if we did this one thing, it'd be awesome.
No, that's a great answer. I love it. Yeah. So I asked this question to many other people. It's because I keep thinking about it myself. You already have experience starting a startup in the U.S. So what I'm wondering is, how can we compete with companies in, let's say, Silicon Valley or other more established ecosystems? Like, one of the biggest issues that I'm seeing is, let's say you want to hire someone and the talent pool in the region isn't as good as many other places. I used to live in Germany. We had, you know, so many amazing universities there, and they had a lot of great students. And, you know, let's say if you want to hire someone on the internet, and that's a global market. And now you're competing with companies again from more established ecosystems who can raise more money, who can afford to pay more money to their employees. Looking at the status of companies that come out of the region, there are a lot of regional successes, but global successes are very few. So what do you think how would you compete with a company from a more established ecosystem like the one in Silicon Valley?
Yeah, it's a great question, and it's a valid question. But for me, we do not have to compete with Silicon Valley. Mm-hmm. You know, if I go back 6 years ago, or 5.5 years ago before I came here, one of the reasons that I was attracted to the market is that there were gaps in technology at a minimum that weren't being filled you know, where successful business models were in Europe and USA already established, and there wasn't, you know, a player here in MENA or the GCC. And I do not like the word, you know, copycat. Maybe it's me too. There's a lot of opportunities to start great businesses with proven business models from other markets and cater it to the region. There's a lot of nuances here in the region. I jokingly talk to people and say I kind of had to relearn 50% of what I knew to be able to understand how things work here, because it's the same yet different. There's a lot of different things that make this region unique, and I wanted to know everything. So we don't, you know, I think there's a way to be focused globally, but do a very good job here in a region and then expand even further. I mean, again, the success stories are there. If you start with Maktoub, go through Talabat, you know, more recently Kareem and Souk, and then you can look at other companies that are having success. You know, these could be acquisition targets for larger companies, whether they're Silicon Valley, US or UK. There could be merger opportunities for these companies, but I don't think we need to compete with Silicon Valley. And then getting specifically to the other part of your question, you know, the workforce, the workforce is going to get stronger, you know, with the Souk acquisition. You know, maybe that is one of the companies, you know, like Google or Groupon, Google in the West Coast, Groupon in Chicago, DoubleClick, an online advertising agency in New York City, you know, that spawns other companies, because a lot of people, I'm sure, at Souk had exposure to what it takes to scale a business, you know, very quickly from startup into a company that's capable of being acquired by Amazon. So I'm not suggesting that everyone at Souk isn't going to stay with Amazon, but, you know, those people may have inclinations to start their own companies. And so the workforce, again, is going to get better with more traction and success stories that we have.
No, I definitely agree with what you said. There's a lot of opportunity here. There's no doubt about it. But maybe I should change the question a little bit and ask, do you think it is likely that a company like, let's say, Google or Slack or Apple can come out of this region? A company of that size, that company that can reach that size.
Right. So I say why not, and I'm going to leave it at that, because, you know, I don't think, you know, I don't think who you said Google, Apple, Slack, you know, maybe everyone in Silicon Valley has anticipation to take over the world, but if you go to a non-Silicon Valley startup ecosystem, you can't plan to have the next Apple. It may or may not happen, but you're going to have a lot of successes and a lot of failures along the way. So I don't think you can force that or plan for that. You can have it as a goal. And again, it may very well happen, and it could happen sooner than we think, you know.
All right.
It's a baseball reference, but, you know, you can't stand at the plate and think you're going to get a home run every time you hit the ball. You can get base hits or singles and have just as much success. And maybe you hit the home run as the regional ecosystem along the way.
Sounds great. So I want to be respectful to your time. We're already at 40 minute mark. So I just want to ask a couple more personal questions, if you don't mind.
Sure.
And close it with that. How do you manage your time? Do you use any tools or methodologies?
So being a former entrepreneur and working for myself or with partners for 18 prior years coming to, or 18 previous years before coming to work for a very large, one of the largest companies in the world, Saudi Aramco. So as an entrepreneur like yourself, there are no set workday hours. It's been hard for me to break and disconnect once the Aramco workday, which is 7 to 4, starts or ends. I sleep about 6 hours a night, but my entrepreneurs and friends and colleagues know that I'm available on WhatsApp. We're doing this podcast on a Saturday. Yeah. I do what it takes to get things done, and that's a full-time job. Even when I'm in the United States on vacation, you know, I'm still having FaceTime calls or WhatsApp from the region and my different responsibilities here.
How about stress? Do you have any habits or tools that you use for handling it?
Yeah, I've been doing my same gym workout since I was in high school, and I think getting the heart rate up and staying in good shape, minus a few vices that I have, has been a good stress reliever, and it absolutely helps me. So for about 30 to 40 minutes now, because I have much more responsibilities in my life, including a 2-year-old, I try to go 5 times a week into the gym right after work for, again, 30 to 40 minutes just to let some steam off.
You're a very positive and optimistic person, so I trust your answer on that.
Yes.
And whatever you do, it should be replicated.
Yes.
What is one thing that you're not very good at that you would like to improve about yourself?
That's a very good question. I didn't know I was going to get the hard questions. one thing, I'm not good at a lot of things. And with every one of the companies that I've started prior to Aramco, one of my personal goals is always to have smarter people than myself around me, because smarter people around me makes me look smarter at the end of the day. That's a challenge in big organizations, or for even small organizations, where the boss or the entrepreneur or the CEO, you know, might feel threatened by having someone smarter than them, you know, in a role, you know, working for them, working with them. But I'm a big believer in, you know, swallow your pride, hire people. I always want to be the dumbest guy in the room, because then I'm going to learn more. So with that, you know, just let's go back to my last venture, and that's Affinity Wind. I am not a CFA2. I'm not a CFO. So I needed a very qualified and competent chief financial officer for Affinity Wind, because it involved big money and big respect. And I got a Wharton grad, a summa cum laude Wharton grad, and he was the chief financial officer for Charter Communications, which today I think is the second or third largest cable company. But he helped launch that in the CFO role, did $5 billion worth of acquisitions over the first 5 years, and he had the experience that I didn't, and I hired him. Same can be said for my chief operating officer. I found a president of a small rural utility company, like SEC here, Saudi Electricity Company, but much, much smaller. And he had just put up a couple of wind turbines in the state of Illinois. So I hired him for his technical expertise, because he was that engineer and that, you know, executive management person that could handle, you know, all of the operations and the technical component to wind. So many examples where I have flaws galore. Let's put it that way.
That's a very good answer. Definitely.
Yeah,
I agree. So can you name some of the resources that helped you learn more about entrepreneurship and startups? I mean, can be books, blogs, websites, or, you know, people?
I love that question, and I wish I had the answer. There's all kinds of great stuff, and the internet is remarkable. But for me, and it's the worst thing to tell, especially a young entrepreneur, I learned more doing it, mostly failing, you know, sometimes succeeding, than I could by reading something in a book, blog, magazine. So doing actually doing was where I got my best experience. And that's where I think, you know, value from former entrepreneurs that have done it before comes from, because there's not many problems that any Saudi company or Bahraini company comes across, you know, that seasoned entrepreneurs don't have something in their past that's relatable. And the other thing important for or at least my personal opinion, is as a mentor or as an investor in these 15 companies, I rarely tell an entrepreneur, do this. You know, here's the problem. You need to do this. What I prefer to do is have them learn from this problem. And so I will help lay out, you know, a decision tree. If you do this, this could happen. Here's the risk. If you do this, this could happen. This could happen, and so on and so forth. And then let them make the decision after analyzing the full situation and talking through it. And again, maybe offering advice from, you know, this didn't work with Affinity Wind, or this did work with eBackups, or this did work with this business plan that I worked on as an adjunct professor at St. Louis University. So it's being able to call upon, you know, past experiences that I think I've learned absolutely the most in my entrepreneurial life.
So as Mark Tyson says, everyone has a plan until they get punched in the face.
Right? Yes. Yes.
So how can people find you on the internet?
Good question. So probably easiest is LinkedIn. And my email address is out there. It's Trey. I'm still using the Affinity Wind domain. Trey, T-R-E-Y, at affinitywind.com. And I'd be happy to speak to anyone that thinks I might be able to help them with.
Great. Trey, I really appreciate you taking the time to do the interview. And as you said, it's a Saturday, and you're taking time off your weekend. So I really appreciate it. Thank you so much.
Sure. Keep up the great work, and good luck with your other ventures as well.
Thank you.
Take care.
Thanks a lot for listening to this episode of the Startups Middle East podcast. You can see the show notes and find out more about the podcast at startupsmiddleeast.com. If you like this episode, I'd love for you to subscribe, rate, or give a review on iTunes. Until next time.